Richard Slotkin is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. You were about to tell us about the basic premise of the book that you have written about Abe Lincoln. Do that both in the local and in the larger. You're thinking about him.
Before you do that, would you?
Later.
Okay, I'll do that later.
Well, I want a predicate, one predicate. And that is, we've been sort of tossing around this word myth.
Yes.
As if we knew what we were talking about. You probably do. I'm less clear. So would you
short
preface
definition?
This with a,
okay.
with a...
A myth is a story drawn from history, which comes through usage to symbolize the meaning of that history for the people of a society of any kind, culture, clan, tribe, nation state. That's basically it.
Thank you.
It's got to have some historical connection in a modern society to function as myth. So an example would be Custer's Last Stand. If I tell you there was a gang fight on the cops were attacked by gangsters on our street and it was like Custer's Last Stand, you know exactly what I mean. Exactly what I'm trying to tell you.
And even if you don't, you think you do.
You think, well, yeah. Yeah, it's familiar. It's a cliche for you, and you
well,
got
in,
it.
In a sense, I don't want to digress too far from where we were, but in a sense, that's part of what you've been dealing with. We internalize these myths and make certain assumptions and act on those assumptions predicated on these myths as symbolic representations.
Yeah.
And Custer is an excellent example. What actually happened at the Little Bighorn and the myth mm-hmm. that grew up around it seemed to be fairly separate.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The reality
well,
is...
Apply that notion to Abe Lincoln.
Yeah, the childhood of Abe Lincoln is mythologized as soon as he starts running for president. He's the rail splitter. He's the rags-to-riches candidate. He's the man who came from a log cabin. And it's presented as a story of... It's the American story of the humble man triumphing. Well, he didn't look at it that way. He was ashamed of having been poor. He was ashamed of his father. He hated his father for being a lumpish, ignorant... bullying guy and
white trash, I think, is pretty much.
Yeah, it's pretty close. Dirt poor and the favorite
keep a job.
The line that I think captures him is he wouldn't go out of his way to make a dollar.
Oh,
he'd get by, but he would not go out of his way to make a dollar. And that's, I mean, Abe would go out of his way to make $3, $5, $1,000 and become president. So I mean,
well, and then the myths that surround his birth mother and his stepmother.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think what I had to do with that. I mean, there's so many of these legends. How he walked miles through the rain to return a book, and I didn't deal with any of that. The idea of the way I approach this kind of thing is you use the myth and the standard cliches about Lincoln. You know that that's what people remember. So you don't have to tell them that. You can remind them in subtle ways and then play against it.
Well, it kind of gives you a head start,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah, and it gives you something to play against. It gives you memory to play against so that when you take a cliche and turn it inside out and show the unexpected about Abe Lincoln, you revivify, you wake up people to how their own language is operating. To take the Custer's Last Stand analogy, if you tell that story from the Indian perspective, in which the Indians are the victims, the losers, rather than the whites, and do that in a credible way, as Berger does in Little Big Man, you alter fundamentally the way people see a crucial episode of their own history. So with Lincoln, he's so impacted in our notions of race and violence, particularly race. For me, the critical thing was to show how a young man of his temperament and brilliance might have perceived the color line as it was presented to him, given what his vocabulary is, given what he learns from the Bible, given what he learns from his school texts, and given what the language of his neighbors gives him.
And again, this is 1810s and 20s.
This is 1810s and 20s, and in which these are people, by the way, who are anti-slavery, but also anti-Negro. And they have this mystical notion that wherever Negroes appear, slavery follows, and therefore anti-slavery and what they would call Negrophobia go together. How does Lincoln get past that? And I should say, by the way, that although I can get an argument with this anytime you like, I do believe that he is not in the classic sense, that our sense, he is not a racist. He believes in racial difference, but for him, the differences do not touch anything vital. The critical question to ask of a 19th century figure is not do they believe in race, because even Frederick Douglass believes in race difference, but do they believe that race difference disqualifies the non-white for self-government? And Lincoln never says that. He's what's called a colonizationist, set the slaves free and colonize them elsewhere. Not because he thinks they can't govern themselves, but precisely because he thinks they can. He just believes that the prejudice against them is so severe that they will never be allowed to be self-governing so long as they stay within the borders. It's not the most enlightened position on slavery, but it's a revealing, for me, it's a revealing position.
Well, and as you correctly say, this is the context of the 1860s, and that by then, and what happened, you know, the world in the perspective of the 1860s is not the world we inhabit today.
But as a novelist, the thing that I have to take from that, and that the thing that I have to worry about, is that I don't get into the political argument that he would be in the 1860s, but to see that belief as evidence of a state of mind about race, which is different from that of his fellows. Frederick Douglass once said that he was the only white leader with whom he could speak as man to man.
Now, Frederick Douglass, for that two people in the world who don't know,
is the leading black abolitionist of the 1840 to between 1840 actually and 1880s. He's the leading figure in black American life.
And he says of Abraham Lincoln,
he is the only great man, by which he meant the only leader. White leader with whom he felt he could speak as man to man with no consciousness of the difference of color. And that tells you something about Lincoln's capacity to make human contact across the color line. Another thing, whenever he speaks of the slave, he always makes an association. How would I feel, or how would you, my white listener, feel if you were in that position? Now, for most of his audience, that's an insult. If you say that a man is like, and I won't use the N-word, that's an insult. They don't think like we do. They're slaves. They've been slaves. If they thought like we do, they would rise up in revolution. Because they haven't, they must be a different kind of being from us. Lincoln never says that, never. He always says, think how you would feel, and how would I feel if I were in that position.
This also goes to the interconnectedness with violence.
Yes.
You know, the fact that they didn't rise up may not be a failure of character. It could be the imminent and fairly frequent use of violence.
Well, and one of the things to recognize is that there is violence, but circumscribed by the circumstances of where they're growing up. Now, in the novel, when Lincoln goes down the Mississippi on a flatboat, he sees the slavery as it was in the 1820s. For most of the Mississippi Valley, it's a frontier institution in which the discipline of the plantation is the discipline of terror and violence, and in which there is violent resistance on the plantations. Slave uprisings that, you know, don't get remarked because they're very local, and the regions that they're in are not networked into some sort of national communications web, which doesn't exist. But there are these local monuments, these trees, the Dead Tree Point, which I cite in the novel, where a couple of rebellious slaves were chained and burnt to death.
Find that sort of individual defiance that was punished in the most severe ways.
So one of the things in the novel that Lincoln has to do is to have encounters with blacks that will teach him that they resent their circumstances just as he would. And he has to also have something in his youth which prepares him to see that the condition of the slave is not unlike something he himself knows. And the what opened it up for me was really thinking about fathers and sons,
You can get started on fathers and sons, but you have about 30 seconds before we're going to go away, so don't get too committed to fathers and sons.
Okay, well, it's basically that Abe's relationship with his father, to him, mimics the kind of master-slave relation.
See, I said there was a great deal more to be said. Our guest is Richard Slotkin. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, and Richard Slotkin will all be back in just a moment. Please do be with us when we return shortly.